time for a podcast already.
Check 1 2, check 1 2, check 1 2, check 1 2.
I didn't know that.
What's up, listeners? Welcome back to another episode of the Garlic Jar Podcast Show. Today, we are coming at you within the first heat wave of summer 2021. Today's episode, we are staying inside and trying to beat the heat, and we're going to have a nice little conversation continuing our assassination series on the assassination of Robert Kennedy. So today, of course, we have back with us the great Sean, and he's going to have a nice little conversation with us.
There
is everybody excited for today?
Oh yeah, I've been thinking about this episode all week. So, and it's kind of funny that you mentioned our heat wave out there, because I tried...
The heat wave?
I tried doing stuff today. Like, I was going to go out there, pull weeds out of the garden boxes, empty the dirt, and I was like, I can't do this. I have to wait till the sun goes down.
Yeah, got to do it before, like, 11.
Yeah.
I think it was, like, 80 degrees at, like, 11 o'clock this morning.
Well, it definitely feels like 95 out there right now, so... But yeah, no, I'm excited.
Sean, what are you doing to stay cool today?
Oh, it's rough, but you know what? I don't mind this weather. It's better than snow.
I agree.
100%
so,
agree.
No complaints.
Yeah, I love the heat, and right before we recorded this, I went up to Dunkin' and got myself a nice coconut refresher.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't tried them, they're delicious.
I'm going to go get a drink after this myself. I'm going to go down to that. Anybody ever go to that Electric City coffee house down there in Peckville by the Veterans Park?
Yeah.
Oh,
they have good specials.
Shout out to them, by the way. A good local business right around our area. They got some really good drinks there. Nice coffee place. It's right next to the park. But I like their seltzer refreshes. I think they're pretty good there. So shout out to that local
business. Oh, the
Italian
sodas?
Yeah. That's what it kind of reminds me of. Yep. But seltzer's pretty good for you. It's better than actual soda. So.
Yeah, I'm a seltzer drinker.
Me too. So yeah, that's pretty much, yeah, I've been excited about this episode. I know that we've been talking about it over the past couple weeks, just preparing for it, and we do have, you said, a special guest with us today, Sean Kane, and I can't wait to dive into it. Sean, you got a lot of stuff to go through, right?
I do, and normally we start with questions, and I do have questions, but... to give RFK his due, I think we should just go into starting with RFK, and then if we have time, we'll do the questions at the end. I don't want to cut RFK short. He deserves a full time slot.
Yeah, let's do questions at the end. That works for me.
But I do want to give props to Jen. On one of her last episodes, it was either the last episode or the one before, Jenna mentioned that the show Project Blue Book.
Yeah.
That they had an episode on Operation Paperclip, and she was right. I went back, and it was on Wernher von Braun, actually, who was a Nazi that they brought over, and he actually became really good friends with Walt Disney, and there's no other way to describe it, but he was instrumental in getting the space program going.
Mm-hmm.
So that episode was on that, so that's a good job by Jen, pointing that out, because she was right, and that's a great episode. If anybody wants to learn anything about Operation Paperclip, go watch that. And Matt, I did look into the name, because I remember you made some comments. You were laughing about the name Operation Paperclip.
Yeah.
A silly name, right? But there actually is some madness to Dulles. The name came from the Nazis had a saying that to them, their superior race, anybody who wasn't considered in their superior race, their life would be worth a paperclip to them. Like their life means nothing to them. And the saying they had. So Dulles, that's why Dulles called it Operation Paperclip, because it was all about bringing the Nazis over.
How? That's what.
Mm-hmm. And it shows you what Dulles is all about.
I mean, I was going to say, that's kind of clever on his part to be thinking of a clever name there, buddy. Touche.
Well, he does make up some stupid names, because we're going to talk about another. Operation he had called Artichoke, which he just named because that's his favorite vegetable.
Oh,
so okay. I mean, he does, so, But there was some madness to that paperclip name.
Very interesting.
Yeah, that's a fact that I didn't know.
That's good trivia. That's very good trivia.
I had to look that up and do a deep dive on that, but
that Project Blue Book, it always keeps coming up in a conversation too. People are because you're not the only ones that recommended it to me. I remember a bunch of people down, you know, past time too, you know, past couple of years, people said, yeah, you should be watching that show. You'd probably get into it. That's
There's
that's really
one I really
got to
write on the list.
I think there's what, two seasons, three seasons.
There was two seasons. They were going to do a third.
They killed it.
And it's interesting because at the end they brought JFK into it.
Yeah.
In the last few episodes, so I could kind of see the direction they were going, and I really was hoping, you know, to see a season three, and I don't know yet what the status is. I know History Channel's not going to do it, but somebody
else
might pick them
up. Yeah, it was still
up
in the air.
But wasn't Project Blue Book more based on, like, extraterrestrial stuff? Wasn't that... Okay.
Paranormal. Yes, it was. Yeah. It was the Air Force's investigation.
Right, and
into
I thought
UFOs.
That... Because I think the big thing that I remember people talking about Blue Book was the fact that didn't Roswell come up in the conversations, the investigation of the Roswell crash in New Mexico?
Oh, yes. They investigated that. It was, there was a Dr. Alan Hynek is who it's based on. He was a scientist that was involved with that. And another interesting thing I found out, the two generals, Jenna, the two Air Force generals, they are based on the two names that we brought up quite a bit, Curtis LeMay, who was the Air Force head of Strategic Air Command, and General Charles Cabell, who became the number two. He was an Air Force general, and then he became the number two guy at the CIA under Alan Dulles, who Kennedy fired after the Bay of Pigs.
Oh, interesting.
And his brother was the mayor of Dallas at the time of the assassination. So that's who those two Air Force generals who were always directing all the traffic and covering everything up. That's who those two guys... Yeah, that's who those two guys are based on. Now, they changed the name for the show.
Of course.
But that's who they're based on.
Okay, yeah. That's a good fact, too.
All right. Well, where to begin?
Well, let's get right into RFK. And to set this up, I just want to start with some quotes, and then we're going to go into, you know, where the country was at the time of the assassination.
Yeah.
But one of the most famous quotes from RFK, and Teddy used it at his eulogy, he said that some see things as they are and ask why. I see things that never were and ask why not. And to me, that sums up everything RFK is all about, because I'm on record. I think he would have been better than JFK. Even, I mean, if he got a shot, because you got to remember he was like, you know, the assistant to JFK. I mean, he was everything to JFK. He was the backup when he was the president. He was right there with him through everything. He was more than attorney general.
Yeah, and he was a senator too.
Well, he was a senator senator from New York. But, I mean, he really was in the middle of everything with the Cuban Missile Crisis and Castro and Khrushchev and everything that was going on. But some of the other quotes, Cesar Chavez, who was the founder of the United Farm Workers, when RFK was shot, and he was still alive, but he was in a coma, he was in the hospital, Cesar Chavez said that this country is going to kill another Kennedy, and then we're not going to have a country. And I think that's a great quote because it sums up, you know, where everybody was at the time. I mean, 1968, obviously I wasn't born, but, you know, I tie it to my parents and everything who lived through it. And the country was just, it was a mess at the time. It was an absolute mess. And, you know, I want to go into a little bit about where the CIA was at the time, too, before we get into all this.
Yeah, give us some background.
Well, I get another quote from our friend James Angleton, and he says, this was on his autobiography. Angleton said, when you were in the presence of, this was on his deathbed, actually. He said this to his autobiographer. He said, when you were in the presence of people like Alan Dulles and David Attlee Phillips and General Ed Lansdale, he says, you were in the presence of people who you undoubtedly understood that at some point they would wind up in hell. And then Angleton took a sip of his coffee and he says, I'll be joining them soon. So Angleton knew the stuff that these guys were doing. I mean, at the end, you know, he knew that all the stuff that him and Dulles were doing was a lot of it was just plain evil. You know, they could hide it behind patriotism and stuff, but, you know, a lot of these operations were just, you know, they were just plain evil.
Agree.
But the CIA in 68, Dulles was really towards the end of his life. Dulles would pass away in like 1970, I think. So he had passed, he's in the process of passing the torch of, you know, his invisible government to Richard Helms, who we mentioned quite a bit. Richard Helms, you know, he was a grandson of a Rockefeller banker by the name of Gates McGrath. He was a military guy. He was Ivy League school. I want to say Princeton or Brown, one of them. And he was mentored by Dulles. So Helms was chosen, you know, early by Alan Dulles to be a successor. And he was groomed for that. And then in 68, Angleton was still running the counterintelligence. David Atlee Phillips was moving up. I think he would eventually become the number three at the CIA, the deputy director of plans in the Western Hemisphere. General Ed Lansdale, who we talked about, he was back in action. He was over in Saigon, over in Vietnam. He was working out of the embassy there, but he really wasn't an attaché. He was undercover running ops, and he was running the Phoenix program over there with David Morales, who we talked about before, and some other CIA guys. And then Robert Mayhew is a name we're going to talk about today. Robert Mayhew worked for Howard Hughes. But he was a deep cover CIA. We talked about him before because he was the guy that Dulles went to broker the CIA mafia plots to kill Fidel Castro. So Robert Mayhew was deep in the Office of Security under the CIA. He's the guy that the original Mission Impossible series is based on.
Okay.
So, you know, he's the guy that the Dulles went to when he wanted to, you know, leave no trace of anything. And he's going to be a big name that's going to come up tonight. So that's just a little bit of, you know, where we were in 68, you know, the quotes, just to set it up. And one thing I want to say before we even get into this, the one thing about RFK is that a lot of people don't understand that he, even though he had to come out and he kind of like, you know, endorsed the Warren Commission, just, you know, but he never believed the Warren Commission. And he always did his own investigation, but he always thought that there was nothing he could do to solve JFK's murder until he had the Office of the Presidency behind him. So there's a guy by the name of Bill Atwood from Look magazine, and he met with Jim Garrison. And this guy was actually shaken by the evidence that Garrison showed him about the CIA's, you know, involvement in JFK's assassination. So Atwood called up RFK, and he told him, he says, you know, all the evidence that Garrison had. And RFK said to him, he said, look it. I know. He says, I know what happened. He says, but I can't do anything about it until I'm president of the United States. And Atwood, he was going to publish this article the next day, and he had a heart attack. And he went into a coma, and who knows if it was a real heart attack or one of those, you know, CIA heart attacks. But it never got published, and he ended up leaving Look magazine, and he never really, you know, got back into writing.
Good timing.
Or anything. But the point, yeah, good timing, but who knows what really happened. But the point is, you know, that RFK knew what happened. And the thing is, RFK was the greatest crime fighter this country ever had. And he was a tremendous attorney general. But he figured out really what happened to JFK within hours of the assassination, because J. Edgar Hoover called him. And this shows you what a prick Hoover is. Hoover calls him up and he says, Bobby, the president's been shot, just like that, like no condolences, nothing. And then he says to him, he called him back a little later, he said, Bob, the president's dead. And he hung the phone up, like no condolences, no, I'm sorry to hear about your brother, you know what I mean? Like
straight to the point.
So, yeah, I guess, but RFK, he after he gathered his thoughts, the first thing he did is he called up John McCone, who was the figurehead at the CIA. He was the guy that after they fired Dulles, they put McCone in. And RFK called him, and in the question he asked him straight out, he said, did you guys kill my brother, meaning the CIA? And then he called in a guy by the name of Harry Williams, who was, he was like the head of one of the heads of the anti-Castro Cuban community that RFK was dealing with. And he asked him, he says, were you guys involved in this? And he says, I want you to find out where your top 100 snipers were and were any of them in Dallas. And then when Ruby shoots Oswald, RFK called in all his people from the Justice Department, and he said, I want you to look into Ruby's ties to the mob, and does any of them specifically have ties to the CIA plots to kill Fidel Castro, meaning Giancana, Roselli, Traficante, all them guys. So RFK figured out pretty much what a lot of people think what happened was, you know, the CIA planned it. The anti-Castro Cubans were the snipers. And then when, you know, Oswald wasn't killed, the CIA sends the mob to put pressure on Ruby to send him in to kill Oswald. I mean, people look, you know, 50 years they've been investigating that. Bobby Kennedy figured that out within hours.
Wow.
That's some heavy stuff right there.
Yeah. So, you know, let's get into RFK. Let's get into 1968. So the country was really devastated by the Vietnam War. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, Johnson got us into the war. We talked about that before. And by 68, I mean, it was a mess. The country was divided. There was protests everywhere. And RFK didn't want to run. He was eyeing 1972 as his run for presidency. He didn't want to get involved in 68, but it got to the point where he just felt that things were so bad that he had to do something. He had to do something because the country was coming apart at the seams. And once he decides to run, it seemed like all that hope that people lost when JFK was assassinated, they got it back. And, you know, you talk to people that lived through that. That's what you hear them say, you know, just for a small window there, they got that feeling back. And I don't know if you guys ever heard the speech that RFK gave when Martin Luther King was assassinated. But the night that King was assassinated, RFK was doing a rally in Indianapolis. And now remember, this is long before cell phones and everything else.
Oh, of
so
course.
People were standing out there, you know, waiting for RFK to come out. And nobody, a lot of them didn't know that Martin Luther King was assassinated. You know, there was no cell phones and up-to-date news, you know. So the police chief in Indianapolis, he told RFK that he didn't feel safe going out there. And he didn't think that RFK should go out there because there was riots all over the country. And RFK told him, he said, look, he says, if you don't feel safe because of stuff you did, that's on you. He says, but I feel perfectly safe and I'm going out there. And I'm going to tell them what happened to Martin Luther King. So RFK went out there and he delivered an unbelievable speech. And John Lewis talked a lot about that because John Lewis was there that night. He was there that night. He was one of the people that was helping Robert Kennedy's campaign. And, you know, RFK basically begged the people, you know, don't riot. He says, honor Martin Luther King and don't riot. And Indianapolis was one of the only big cities in the country that night that did not riot. So just if you ever get a chance, just look up that speech because it's really just an incredible speech by RFK. But it goes to show you, you know, what he was all about. And, you know, you see the things like, when he went down to Mississippi, and he went in the poorest neighborhoods of Mississippi, and he just saw the poverty there, and he couldn't believe it because remember he grew up, you know, he grew up wealthy, so he didn't understand any of that. And if you ever get a chance to see that, there's footage of that, and there's also a great documentary on Netflix. I don't know if you ever seen the Bobby Kennedy for Presidency. I think that's what it's called.
I haven't seen it, no.
But that's a really good documentary. I recommend everybody to go see that. Okay. But it goes to show you what, you know, it really goes into that, you know, what the country was going through in 68. And when Bobby's assassinated, you know, it just devastated. Everything that happened in 63 kind of came back, you know, like all that feeling, like all the hope was gone. And you could see that on the train ride. I don't know if you guys ever seen the footage of when they were bringing Bobby Kennedy's body from New York back to Arlington, and they were riding the train, and the people that were just out there, you know, giving their last, you know, salute to Bobby. It was just incredible. There was like, they estimated like 3 million people along the tracks.
Wow.
But but people think it was even more than that. I mean, it was just incredible. And the thing is, you've seen the diversity. You've seen like white people, black people, Latinos, Native Americans. You've seen young people, like kids and people in their 20s and elderly people, you know, people in their 70s. I mean, it was just the diversity. Like, he just touched, like, he really got a handle on the middle class and the poor in this country, you know. And just when you see the look on the faces of the people alongside that train, you know, you just see that, you know, all the hope is gone. Everything, like, everything that they had is just, you know, it's just leaving on that train. And it's just, and then you hear people like John Lewis talk about that. Like, I've seen a lot of interviews with him talking about that, and it's just, you know, it's just heartbreaking.
Well, you go back to saying, you know, sure. Yeah, I mean, that's a, you know, you're bringing up, it's almost like another, it's 1963 all over again. It's, you know, the hope
it
and the love for Kennedy, you know, now it's coming back, and it happened with Bobby. And I think the best part about, you know, what you're saying out of this worst situation is that, like, you talk about the diversity surrounding those tracks. You know, I think you look at a worse situation. I mean, yeah, it is. It's upsetting. It's worse. But the uplifting part is that people did come together and they showed that at a time where, you know, the country was in a bad spot.
Country was in a real bad spot. You're right. And I think he just had a genuine, like, it was amazing how a guy who was so, you know, really so wealthy and you know, so privileged, that he had such a feeling for the poor and middle class, especially the poor. I mean, he, you know, he really wanted to help in you know, the poverty that he's seen when he went down to some of these cities down in the South. He just could not believe that people were living in these conditions.
Wow.
Yeah.
But, you know, the effects of that assassination, I mean, that assassination, and I really don't, I'll be honest with you, I don't think the country ever recovered from those four assassinations. I said it before. I think that was the last hope. Like, that assassination just, I mean, number one, it split the Democratic Party.
Yeah,
and,
for sure.
And you yep. can see that, you know, the Chicago Convention in 68 that year, where all the riots were, and Mayor Daley in Chicago was involved, and, you know, the protests against the Vietnam War, and it really gave Richard Nixon the opportunity to win.
Yeah, take advantage of a situation.
Well, sure, but I don't think Nixon against RFK, Nixon
no.
was not going to win. I mean, and the thing is, you know, Bobby was on his way to getting the Democratic nomination. I mean, once he says, it's off to Chicago and let's win there, after he wins the California primary, I mean,
yep.
he's on his way. And, you know, and the other thing is, you know, like we talked about, it ended all the hope, you know, everything. And it also allowed the continuation of the Vietnam War, because there's no doubt about it that Bobby Kennedy was going to end that war. He knew that JFK
yep.
was pulling out, because, like I said, he was involved in everything that JFK was doing. And he knew that you know, JFK did not want to expand that war. And he was going to pull out. There was no doubt about that. And you know, that also ended no chance of ever bringing back any of JFK's
yeah.
policies, you know. And the thing is, you know, like his Africa policies and everything, the Middle East, like none of that was going to be brought back. We talked about Johnson. He went in a totally different direction almost everywhere, you know. And the other thing is that, you know, it also ended any credible investigation into the JFK's death. Like I said, RFK knew that, you know, he knew Garrison was onto something, but he knew Garrison couldn't win. You know, he knew Garrison was up against a guerrilla, and he, you know, he really felt that until he was president, there wasn't going to be a credible investigation into his brother's death.
Right.
And once he had the office of the presidency, he made it clear to a lot of people in his inner circle, he was going after them, and he, you know, Dulles and all these guys, Rockefeller, he was going after all of them. He told people in his inner circle he was going to get every one of them.
Yeah, you know, right now, I mean, I got, you know, two points that are flashing through my head right now are, okay, number one, if we go back to the whole point with Nixon and RFK, right, because, you know, I'm just kind of mm-hmm. thinking, like, conversations going back with my uncle, because I told you how big he was into JFK, and he loved all this kind of stuff, the history buff. You know, his
right.
thing with Nixon was is that, and I specifically remember him saying this, I mean, martini in hand, too, if I'm not mistaken. He had a martini. And that was a rare thing, because John loved his martinis only at a time when it was necessary. But I remember him specifically saying that was the doomsday, because right there where you had a race going on, there was no other choice. People kind of panicked, and they said, well, Jesus, who else do we pick now? I mean, because it almost was it was almost a sure thing that Robert was going to get it. But then everybody, again, they started questioning, are politicians behind this? Nobody knew what to even expect or think on the Democratic side. And I remember that specifically. My uncle even said they were almost blaming, were the politicians themselves even to blame for, you know, killing off another Kennedy. And, you know, and then people said, you know what, we have no other choice. We better go with Nixon.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the second point that's kind of flashing through my mind here right now, like a news headline, is going back to what you just said, Sean. You know, the thing that kind of just keeps piercing at me here, like, God, it's picking at me like a tattoo needle. You know, it's that point that you said that, well, we almost had a story. We had a guy that was about to publish an article. He just died of a heart attack the next day. So now we didn't find out that it was the CIA. You know?
Right. Absolutely.
And of course, I mean, you go back to it and we look at it. I mean, that's what everybody wants to know about the controversy and the conspiracy. It wasn't, you know?
And, you know, just an interesting thing is that, you know, by 68, all the people that were involved in JFK's assassination, they were aligned and directly aligned against Bobby Kennedy. I mean, it was, you know, you could see it all happening again if you look back now. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And in fact, here's an interesting story. RFK went on a trip to South Africa, and the South African government, because remember, back at that time was apartheid. So JFK wanted nothing to do with the South African government until, you know, the people had the freedom over there. And he, you know, but the thing is, guys like Alan Dulles, they always considered South Africa one of our greatest allies, even during apartheid. They said they always backed us during, you know, World War II. And Dulles had great relations. In fact, you know, there's a lot of documentation into right now with Dulles coming out with the South African government in cahoots with the assassination of a guy I mentioned before, Dag Hammarskjöld, the Secretary General of the UN. Anyway, I'm kind of getting off tracks there, but when RFK goes over to South Africa, at first his setup team went out there first to make sure everything is set up and everything, and there was a little incident there. I forget what exactly happened, but there was some kind of security issue and there was some kind of incident, and then it really wasn't a big deal, and it got taken care of. But when the team came back, RFK asked them about that, and they said, well, how did you know about that? Because, you know, we didn't tell you about it. We didn't think it was any big deal. We didn't want to make you nervous. And he said, well, Richard Helms over at the CIA, he said he called me, because by this time Richard Helms was the director, and he says he called me and let me know about it. And the guy's, his assistant said to him, he said, well, why in the world would the CIA be telling you about this incident? Like, and RFK is like, well, they're sending a message to me. They want me to know that they're watching me. And they're keeping an eye on me. Yeah, so RFK knew. He knew that Helms and these guys and Dulles and all these guys and Phillips and Angleton, he knew that, you know, he was up against them, and he knew that. But, you know, he needed the power of the presidency to any type of investigation into JFK's death, and he really believed that.
Wow.
Yeah. So, do we want to get into this, or do we want to take a little break?
Yeah, here? I think we're almost at the halfway point, so why don't we take a break? So, thanks, everybody, for sticking with us this far, and sit tight, and we'll be right back with you with the back half of the hour.
All right, welcome back, everybody. We are just joining into the second half of the episode here that we're with our special guest, Sean Kane, and we are still discussing some real in-depth information here about the RFK assassination. So, Jenna, Sean, we all back from our break. All right, and we are ready to press forward with more detail. So, Sean, whenever you want to pick back up.
Yes.
I got my walk.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes, I have my coconut refresher.
All right. Well, June 5th, 1968, RFK is in the Patriot Ambassador Hotel. He's shot, and a young man by the name of Sirhan Sirhan is arrested. RFK had just won the California primary, and he was on his way to, you know, getting the nomination for
the presidency.
President of the United States for the Democratic Party. And the one thing is that I have a theory on this, that this, you know, this, and we're going to go into detail that this was another intelligence operation, but I really believe that had RFK not won that night, then this assassination wouldn't have been green-lighted. Like, everything was a go. There was no way he was getting out of the pantry, the Ambassador Hotel. There was no way he was getting out, just like Dallas, had he won the primary. But had he lost that, then the thing is, you know, he would have struggled to get the nomination, so he wouldn't have been a threat. So I don't think if he had won, you know, that that it probably would have been aborted. But the fact that he did win, now all of a sudden he's a threat, and we know what's coming. He's going to end the Vietnam War. He's going to investigate his brother's death. You know, he's going to bring back all of his policies that the powers to be took, you know, that reversed, basically, you know. So this young man, Sirhan, is arrested. And it looks like an open and shut case, you know. But here's the thing. The autopsy was done by a guy by the name of Thomas Noguchi. And we mentioned this before because I believe Nate the Great asked a question on this.
Nate the Great.
But Thomas Noguchi, his autopsy said that RFK was shot at point-blank range, meaning the barrel of the gun was a half inch or less in the back of Bobby Kennedy's head. Now, the problem with that is that that Sirhan was never in back of Bobby Kennedy, and he was never that close to him. Every witness in the pantry puts Sirhan a distance of 3 to 6 feet in front of Bobby Kennedy. So even if he reached out with his gun, and Bobby Kennedy turned around, which there's no evidence that he did, there's no way to barrel a gun could get that close. So right there, Sirhan did not kill Bobby Kennedy. That's a fact. And we're going to see later at the trial that this was never brought up. And we're going to find out why it wasn't brought up when I get into who Sirhan's attorney was. But for now, you just know that the shot that killed him was point-blank range in the back of the head. There was two other shots that entered his back. And the thing is, like I said, all the witnesses put Sirhan in front. And there was Rosie Greer, who I'm sure you heard the name. He's a Hall of Fame football player. He was one of RFK's bodyguards. And there was a big German guy. I can't think of his name, but he was like about 6'7". And they jumped on Sirhan as soon as the bullets started flying, as soon as he heard the gunshots. They jumped on him. And there was the ballistics. The acoustics picked up at least 16 shots. Sirhan's gun only held 8 bullets. And here's another thing. So the ballistics could never match the ballistics, actually, to Sirhan's gun with the kill shot. But there was a criminalist by the name of Dwayne Wolfer who worked for the LAPD, and we're going to talk about him quite a bit tonight. But he's just awful. I mean, but he said that the gun, the bullets matched in the other victims, because there was other victims that were shot that night. I want to say there was like 4 other people that were shot in the pantry that night. But here's the thing, from new evidence, there's an author by the name of Lisa Pease who did a lot of great work. She's probably the leading journalist on the RFK assassination. But she discovered from the declassified documents that the bullets that Wolfer had were in an envelope labeled with the gun serial number hashtag H18602. The problem is that Sirhan's gun had a serial number of H53725. So the bullets didn't match. So I ask you guys, what is Sirhan sitting in jail for 50 years when we just proved that the kill shot of Bobby Kennedy could not have been him, and the bullets that were pulled out of the other victims didn't match his gun? So what is this guy doing sitting in prison for 50 years?
Yeah,
that's a little weird. And you know what? To kind of jump on top of this topic here, too, I want to say I saw something. Was it last year or maybe the year before? I want to say it came out, and I know it was wintertime, but it might be 2 years ago. Sean, I'm going to find you the video. But okay. I do remember that they were talking to another person that was there, an eyewitness testimony. And I guess that was somebody that was, they were also convinced and pretty much saying Sirhan did not kill Robert Kennedy. So that's just another, you know, person adding or chiming into this where you're talking about Sirhan.
Well,
But I guess what they're saying is that his shot was not the one that killed Robert Kennedy.
No. Well, here's the thing. I'm gonna go even further. I don't think he fired any shot. He was firing blanks. Mm-hmm. Sirhan was a distraction. I mean, and the thing is, his gun only held 8 bullets. And the acoustics, like I said, they picked up, I want to say, like 14 to 16 shots. Plus, there was more bullet holes found than 8, like in the door frames and everything. And on the acoustic test, twice on the test, shots are too close together to come from the same gun. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So there definitely had to be more than one gun. But I, like I said, I think the evidence proves that Sirhan was firing blanks. He was a distraction. Now, this is where we're probably going to lose some people, because I'm going to get into the MK Ultra CIA mind control people, and people are going to think, Sean, you're out of your mind. And, you know, and this is the thing, is I know I'm going to lose people. If you want to believe it, the fact is, you know, you're looking at the evidence. Sirhan was a distraction. So if you want to believe that he was sent in as some kind of like suicide bomber just to get all the attention on him, then you can believe that. But I think he was hypnotized, and we're going to get into that. And I know a lot of people are going to say, you know, Sean, come on, you're crazy. But the fact of the matter is, and when we do the Manson episode, we're going to talk about MK Ultra quite a bit. But the CIA was dealing with mind control for 20 years, you know. So, I mean, they had all different operations. I mentioned the artichoke, which was Dulles named after his favorite vegetable, Bluebird. There was about 5 different operations before they ended up with the MK Ultra, which, like I said, lasted for 20 years, and it dealt a lot with hypnosis. And at the beginning, what the CIA was trying to do is they were trying to create a Manchurian candidate. They were trying to, you know, create a programmed assassin. And, you know, one of the things that from the files, now Richard Helms destroyed most of the files after Watergate. When we do the Watergate episode, we'll get into that. But he destroyed, which I don't understand how that's not obstruction of justice. Like, he actually literally burned all the files. Like, but whatever, you know, he gets away with everything. But but one of the things that in the files is that the CIA said that they were successful in replacing real memories with false memories. So there's a lot of stuff with this MK Ultra, and like I said, we don't have a lot of the files because Helms destroyed a lot of them. But what we do have is just—it's unbelievable the experiments they were running on citizens that, you know, the citizens had no knowledge of these experiments. And 1954 document that was recovered describes effects to find ways to seduce the subjects to perform acts of attempted assassinations. And this is what I said, they were trying to create a Manchurian candidate, but what it looked like is that they felt it was too risky because there was too many factors that you couldn't control. But to control, to make a program, say, distraction, like I think Sirhan was, that's something that I think they were successful with the MK Ultra program. Now, when you look at Sirhan that night, right, there's a lot of witnesses that thought that he was drugged and he was on something. And he has no memory of what happened that night. Like, he can't recall what the heck happened. And he had been drinking, you know, and he was seen with the girl. And I'm sure, Matt, you heard about the girl with the polka dot dress.
Yep.
Yep.
Well, he was seen with her, and you know, that's a big thing, and that's, she's never really been identified.
This is like talking about the umbrella guy, you know, like when you,
yes, yep, it is, yep. I know. There's always, and this is what this thinks of a CIA intelligence operation, all this stuff, you know what I mean? It's the umbrella man, it's the tramps on the train. I mean, it's all this stuff. I mean, it's all over again. It's like Martin Luther King with the 2 Mustangs, yep. And there's always something like that in these intelligence ops. But anyway, his last memory, Sirhan's last memory, is of the girl in the polka dot dress pouring him coffee. And witnesses, they said that he felt like he was in under some kind of trance. And the thing is, if Sirhan was drugged, we don't know, because the official blood tests of Sirhan got lost, if you could believe that.
Ah.
I mean, yeah, maybe they put it with JFK's brain because they lost that,
yep,
too. But how in the world but I mean, again, the LAPD did a horrible job in this investigation. But the LAPD also destroyed the door frames from the crime scene. Okay? And the door frames had more than 8 bullet holes in them, which Sirhan's gun only held 8 bullets. And then there was a young kid by the name of Scott Enyard. I think he was like 16 or 17, and he was in the pantry that night, and he took a film of that. And the film was confiscated right after it, and the LAPD lost that film.
Great.
So they take the film from the kid, and then they lose it. So the thing is, and according to him, he was filming the whole thing when the shots went down. So he had everything on camera of what would have happened. Now, you know, cameras in 1968, who knows how good they were, who knows what would have been on that. But it sure as hell would have been nice to see, no?
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm.
But again, they lost that. They lost the drug test. They lost the brain. JFK, I mean, it's just ridiculous. The door frames get destroyed. The MK Ultra files get destroyed.
And this is why we keep saying that there's nothing more than a conspiracy on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just... And then the other thing is, I mentioned before Sirhan's lawyer, right? Sirhan's lawyer was a guy by the name of Grant Cooper, who was a CIA-friendly lawyer. He was, at the same time he was defending Sirhan, he's defending... Johnny Roselli, the mafia guy from Chicago that was involved in the CIA Castro plots, assassination plots, and he defended him on behalf of the CIA. He was a CIA friendly lawyer.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you have to ask yourself, who is his real client? Is it the CIA or is it Sirhan? Because Grant Cooper gets the information from Thomas Noguchi's autopsy that Sirhan could not have done the shot because it came from point-blank range. And he never introduced that at the trial. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, to me, is grounds for disbarment.
And
is it not?
Yeah.
I mean, you have to defend your client.
Yep.
If you have evidence your client is innocent and you don't present that evidence at trial, I mean, what are you doing? Like, who's your real client? You know what
right.
I'm saying?
Yep. And real quick, just to let you know, I did find that video, Sean. I'm going to send that over to your way.
Okay.
So you could look at that in your email whenever you want. But basically, it just goes back to what you just said here. Because in the video, this guy is pretty much saying that he thinks that the shot, that if a shot came from Sirhan, it wasn't the one that hit Bobby. It was the one that hit me because this was a victim.
It was a victim.
Yep, he was there and he was shot, and he believes Sirhan's shot hit him. And of course, now we're at the unknown of who
and
really shot.
And I get
shot.
That if he's pointing the gun at him, you know what I mean. And he thinks, but the fact is, you know, we know from the evidence today that the bullets that were pulled out of all
it
the
doesn't
victims
match up.
Match a different gun serial
yep.
number.
It doesn't match up.
You know, so but I understand what he's saying. He sees the guy pointing the
yep.
gun at him. You know, he's not, you know, how does he know he's firing blanks?
Exactly, exactly.
You know? But the thing with this hypnosis in the MKUltra program, I know a lot of people aren't going to believe it, but the thing is, a lot of experts say that there's a very small percentage of people that could be susceptible to hypnosis. I tried it, I can't. It doesn't work on me. And I think it's like very, like, I think it's under 3% of the population.
Yeah.
But you know, a lot of Sirhan's attorneys, I mean, when they said that, they brought in experts to hypnotize them, and they said, the experts said that they never saw anybody that was as susceptible to hypnosis as Sirhan. I mean, he was so, like, susceptible to it. It was just unbelievable. So, you know, when we start looking at this, there was a doctor, William Bryan, a hypnotist who worked for the CIA, and he was on right before, he was on TV, you know, he identified Sirhan saying that he was mind controlled, and he bragged to people that he hypnotized them for the CIA and this and that.
Yep.
And William Bryan's he's a big time suspect in this because he had a lot of involvement with Sirhan. There's a lot of documentation that puts Bryan with Sirhan, and he was going to his office, and he was on, you know, and what was he doing there? You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, this guy's an expert in hypnosis. And he's tied to Sirhan, and he was a prominent, you know, he was the president of the American Institute on Hypnosis. He was famous for hypnotizing the Boston Strangler,
yep.
Alberto DeSalvo, and he claimed that he found a motive for him. And now, I don't want to get off on that tangent, but there's a lot of evidence today that he really wasn't the Boston Strangler, but I don't want to go down that route, you know, that hole, but... He also was the chief of medical training for the Air Force, and it was nicknamed the brainwashing section. And that was heavily, they were working with the MKUltra program. So this guy, Brian, was involved in a lot of things. And the interesting thing about the MKUltra program, the whole thing was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. Yeah, so Rockefeller's funding this whole thing. And that's a fact. That's the absolute documented fact. You know, and Helms was heavily involved in that. This is why, you know, he got rid of all the records. He had his technical service staff working with James Angleton over in counterintelligence.
Yeah.
And they were launching all kind of joint experiments in hypnosis. And one of them was called the ZR Alert, and it was a joint operation with the NSA. Mm-hmm. And this is where, you know, there's also names coming up. Dr. Julian West, that we mentioned before, he's going to be prominent in the Manson, when we talk about Manson. But Dr. West, he was the guy that visited Jack Ruby. And then when he left, Jack Ruby was a mess. So whatever he did to Ruby, he was totally,
shattered him.
You know, he shattered him. You know, and the CIA, they also had, you know, Sidney Gottlieb was the guy he was a scientist that was the head of the MKUltra program. They also employed a master magician by the name of John Mulholland. Yep. And the thing is, they were always, you know, they were into the black magic and dark arts and just, you know, the stuff you read about this MKUltra. This went on for 20
years.
Like,
it sounds like voodoo, you know, like, Mike.
It really does. It really does.
What a bunch of witch doctors out there or something, you know?
Oh, it's just unbelievable.
But no, I mean, everything is panning out to what you're pretty much saying here, because, I mean, I just found this video. Like I said, I sent it over to your way. But, like, the big thing that I'm reading here, just in comments, as you're talking, right? Here it is. Well, why don't we hypnotize Saran Saran, right? And then see what comes out. Then there's people saying, oh, here we go again. Perhaps it was John Wilkes Booth who shot Robert Kennedy. You're going to get comments like that.
You're going to get comments like that. You know
but here's
mean?
Here's one right here that we're just talking about. You're talking about Project MKUltra. It's right here in the comments. Television light comes on, kind of blinding. And then how come nobody's been talking about Project MKUltra?
Yeah.
There you go.
You know, and let's get into a little bit more stuff here. So there was a witness, Sandra Serrano, okay? And she witnessed the girl in the polka dot dress with two men that they went inside. And then she identified one of the two men as Sirhan. But then the girl in the polka dot dress and the other man, a guy by the name of Michael Wayne, who we're going to talk about, they came back out and Sirhan wasn't with them. And she heard them say, we got him, we killed him. And she thought they were talking to her. And she asked, who did you kill? And they said something that affects Senator Kennedy's down, I don't know. But there was witnesses that seen that they had like an earpiece. So obviously they were talking to somebody else. They weren't talking to her. But she was a pretty good witness. And she identified, you know, they never identified the girl in the polka dot dress, but she was a really good witness, and she was destroyed by the lead investigators. And this is where we get into, it's Dallas all over again. People ask the question, well, why didn't we get, you know, information on this? Well, the investigation was destroyed. And the two guys that were in charge of the investigation, which was called Special Unit Senator, was a guy by the name of Manuel Pena and Hank Hernandez. Okay? And they were in the LAPD Intelligence Unit. And we talked about before the involvement with the CIA and police department intelligence units. They work together. They're all part of the intelligence community. And Pena, he was in the Navy in World War II. He was in the Army in Korea. He was a military intelligence officer in France. He worked for the CIA on several operations before joining the LAPD. Then he retired from the LAPD to join the AID organization, which we talked about many times on this podcast. That's a CIA front. You know, He was actually involved in special training at the farm, which we talked about before, the CIA special base where Alan Dulles was there the whole weekend at assassination where he was fishing. And then he returns to the LAPD. Now, Hank Hernandez, he worked for AID as well. And he also was an military intelligence officer in Vietnam, Laos, and all through South America, which is all hot spots for the CIA running many operations. And He ran a security firm that handled a lot of cargo accounts for the government. And then he joins the LAPD and he gets into the intelligence unit. So these two guys, there's no doubt, like if you listen to the transcripts of their interrogation of Sandra Serrano. I mean, they destroyed her. They made her, you know, like a suspect. You know what I mean? Like, they just totally destroyed it. And then they just wore her down, and then she kind of retracted everything she said. So, you know, they absolutely destroyed the investigation. So, yeah. So, it's like I said, it's Dallas all over again. So now, another thing that I mentioned on one of the other podcasts, the only person, okay, that was in position to take that headshot on Bobby Kennedy was a guy by the name of Eugene Thayne Caesar. And we mentioned him before. And Caesar worked, he was a last-minute replacement for this firm, Ace Security, that was handling security. But, I mean, he should have deep state tattooed on his forehead. I mean, he worked at Lockheed Martin. He worked under the Skunk Works. I know, Matt, you probably heard that term, you know, dealing with all the UFO stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And he worked at Hughes Aircraft. And we talked about Howard Hughes, who worked at Howard Hughes' organization, was Robert Mayhew. And Robert Mayhew ties to Eugene Thayne Caesar. Caesar used to work for him. So once you realize that Caesar ties to Mayhew, then you realize that this is a CIA operation. And the interesting thing is, Caesar recently died. He was in the Philippines, and he was living like a king over there. And he made this video before he died, this racist video where he just lashed out against the Kennedys on civil rights and how they were for civil rights and everything. And like I said, he's the only guy that's in position to take that shot. So either somebody put the gun over his shoulder and shot Bobby Kennedy, and he knows who did it, or he did it himself, because nobody else was that close to Bobby Kennedy. He was right in back of him. He actually is the guy, that the security guard that had Bobby Kennedy by the arm and lured him into to the pantry.
Okay.
Yeah, and the thing is, we could go on about Caesar. I mean, he had secret clearance. He had national security clearance. He worked, you know, Lockheed Martin. I mean, he worked for Hughes Aircraft. He worked for Robert Mayhew. And the thing is, Robert Mayhew connects to every single person in this case. He connects to Peña Hernandez. He connects to Younger, who was the district attorney. I mean, Robert Mayhew he's definitely the guy that ran this show. There's no doubt about it. And like I said, Lisa Pease, I mentioned before, she did a lot of great work. And if you ever get a chance to read the book, A Lie Too Big to Fail, that's a great book on everything on the assassination. And just an interesting, here's another interesting thing. Ace Security, where Caesar worked, right? After, we mentioned before, Wolford, the criminalist.
Yeah.
Well, after he retired from the LAPD, he became the president of Ace Security.
Interesting.
Now, that's just a coincidence, right?
Yep.
Like, that wasn't like a handoff, like, hey, pal, you did a great job, so here's your nice CEO position, you know?
How interesting.
But, yeah. But let's more on Mayhew. So there's a guy that worked for Howard Hughes by the name of John Mayer, or John Meyer, his name was. And he loved Kennedy, and he got real suspicious of Robert Mayhew. And as soon as he heard the name on the news, Eugene Thayne Caesar, he knew that Caesar worked for Mayhew, and he knew this was a Mayhew operation. So he started to do a deep dive into his own investigation, into what happened, and he got a lot of evidence on Mayhew. So what did he do? He takes it to J. Edgar Hoover, okay? And he presents all the evidence to Hoover, and Hoover looks at him and he said, look it. He said, we know this was a Mayhew CIA operation, but he says, people think I'm all powerful and everything, but when it comes to the CIA, I can't do a thing about them. And the thing is, Hoover wouldn't do anything about it. He didn't care less that Bobby Kennedy was dead anyway. You know, but the thing is, it goes to show you, we talked about this before, Hoover's not going to take on Dulles and Angleton and all these guys. He's not taking on the CIA. He knows his role, and even though the evidence was presented to him, he's not investigating that. You know?
Yeah, for sure.
And, oh, there's just no doubt. And, you know what, I just want to read, let me read a page from Lisa P's book on Robert Mayhew, because she could sum him up better than,
yeah, go ahead,
than I could and anything. But she says, here's what she says. Two different sources told me that Robert Mayhew had been behind the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. But even without those sources, Mayhew seemed the obvious choice. The assassination of Robert Kennedy required comprehensive planning that clearly included the following: control of LAPD's investigation, control of the DA's investigation, control of the sheriff's deputies who were first to arrive in the crime scene, control of Sirhan's defense team, access to trained assassins, access to the patsy that could be hypnotized and taken fall for the crime. CIA had power to control and provide all of this, but more specifically, Mayhew connected directly to every point above. Mayhew had friends in the deepest, darkest corner of the CIA, the Office of Security, the component that ran the mind control programs like MKUltra, and that bugged CIA employees to prevent them from leaking to others. He was extremely well connected at the highest realms of power in this country and had access to nearly unlimited funds. And he had provable experience in running assassination plots for the CIA through his contacts with Johnny Roselli. The Mission Impossible TV series was said to have been based on Robert Mayhew's company, Robert Mayhew Associates, which fronted for CIA activities and provided cover to CIA employees. Mayhew also had friends in the LAPD and Sheriff's Office. He had run CIA operations in conjunction with the LAPD in the past. So I think that sums up everything you want to know about Mayhew. And like I said, Mayhew was the guy that Dulles and Angleton and these guys turned to when they wanted no trace of any government involvement.
Right.
Yeah, this is, I don't know. I like, there's a lot of questions going through my mind right now.
Well, ask away, Matt. Ask away.
No, I mean, it just comes down to the, like I said, it's not to sound, you know, negative here, get off, you know, the tangent and stuff like that, but like, I just want to know already. Like, quit beating around the bushes here. Like, reveal the truth already. You know, like
they're not going to tell you the truth. They're not going to tell you the truth. And here's an interesting story. So, this is really great. So, there was a guy by the name of Caliber Khan who was Savak. He was Iranian intelligence, and He really hated the Shah of Iran, so he turned on the Shah of Iran. And we know, I talked about the backstory, Mossadegh and Iran wanted to nationalize the oil. Dulles and Rockefeller had a coup, got him out of there. They put the Shah in Dulles, Rockefeller, Helms. All these guys were close to the Shah. He was their puppet. And anyway, Caliber Khan was leading his own intelligence investigations against the Shah. And he found evidence connecting Alan Dulles, David Rockefeller, and Henry Luce, who we talked about, who was an enemy of Kennedy's, that owned Time magazine and all them, Life magazine. And Caliber Khan was investigating the USA that was going to Iran and other countries. And he found that money was being directed into the Shah of Iran's into accounts, Swiss bank accounts connected to the Shah of Iran, David Rockefeller, Alan Dulles, and Henry Luce. And he really started to, you know, launch an investigation into all this, and he took it to Congress. And now this is where I get so upset with Congress. Like, this is where an investigation should have been launched by Congress. You have aid money that's being directed from the United States to other countries. And here you have Dulles, Rockefeller, Henry Luce redirecting the money to their own use. You know what I mean? And what do you think Congress did? Congress did nothing. As soon as they hear the name Dulles and Rockefeller, it's just like J. Edgar Hoover. They're not taking these guys on.
Yeah.
So they do nothing. But the interesting thing is that through this investigation, Caliber Khan ends up at the Ambassador Hotel the night that Bobby Kennedy's assassinated.
Convenient.
I mean, what was he doing there? Yep. What was he doing there? Like, no offense to you guys, but 50-some years later, I shouldn't have to be talking to you guys on a podcast wondering about how in the world illegal funds with Rockefeller and Dulles lead to the place where Bobby Kennedy's assassinated. Like, I shouldn't have to fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
You know what I'm saying? So anyway, what happens is Caliber Khan ends up getting destroyed. Instead of Congress, you know, helping him out with this investigation, they let Rockefeller and Dulles destroy him. They actually try to say that his daughter was the girl in the polka dot dress and all this stuff. I mean, it's just nonsense. And that he was involved in the assassination and everything. And what he was doing there that night, I don't know. I can't tell you. But I think it's pretty interesting that, you know, an investigation into legal funds by Dulles and Rockefeller lead him to that location. That's I would like to know how in the world he got there. You know what I mean?
Yep. Man, it's...
So, yeah, I mean, it's just, you know...
No, but I mean, it does. It just goes back to, like, man, so many, like you said, the polka dot dress. I mean, we go back to the CIA angle here and everything like that. Like, it's just, there's so much built up into this, you know? I wouldn't even know where to begin. Like, I'd have to sit down. Like, here's what, I'll give you this, Sean. The next episode that we do, I will definitely have a couple questions for you, because I think right now I just have to mind settle and see where what I want to ask, because I'm thinking of like 10 different things here right now, and I just don't know how to voice them out.
Going through the motions.
Right, and it's right. The wheels are turning, but I just can't get the right words or the structures out, because before I go and say something, I want to actually make sure I ask something right, you know. But. It's actually pretty interesting that you brought that up, because as soon as anybody hears that, the girl in the polka dot dress, I mean, you're talking about the RFK tapes. That's like going back to JFK with the umbrella guy, you know?
Yeah, I know. I mean,
they're weird images.
But the thing is, the facts though show you that Sirhan couldn't have pulled the shot off. Eugene Thayne Caesar was the only guy that could have took that shot. The bullets pulled out of the other victims don't match the gun that Sirhan was carrying.
Yep.
I mean, you know, and then this whole thing with Rockefeller and Dulles. I mean, you know, why did Congress not investigate this?
Yep.
You know? So, I mean, it's just, and like I said, I know a lot of people are going to debunk the hypnosis, mind control thing. They're probably not, you know, people's going to think, Sean, you're out of your mind. But
that's okay.
I mean, yeah, whatever. I mean, I'm looking at the evidence. You put so how do you get Sirhan there? I mean, I just proved he didn't fire a bullet. What was he doing there? You're telling me he was like a suicide bomber that was just sent as a distraction?
Yeah.
And how come he has no recollection of any of this? You know?
Yep. No, it is. It's strange. It's a strange occurrence.
And then why did his CIA friendly lawyer not bring out any of this that could have proved his innocence?
Yep.
You know, the trial was a sham. Sirhan's trial wasn't. It was to make sure that you know he was convicted of the crime.
Oh man, definitely watch that video though, Sean. I want to see what you would think about it. But another question, or one question, I could give you before okay. we kind of conclude. Is there anything out there? Now, I do remember you saying something earlier in the podcast episode that there is a documentary out there on Netflix about Bobby Kennedy.
Yes.
But is there anything specifically out there about the RFK tapes? Like, I mean, or would this documentary kind of cover
that?
Or?
The documentary did touch on the assassination, and it did bring up some questions. But it's really more about Bobby Kennedy's life and everything he was doing.
Okay.
But it does have a, you know, there is like a piece there on the assassination, but it's definitely worth watching. But if you really want the book I mentioned, A Lie Too Big to Fail by Lisa Peace, that's the best book that I've ever written, or I've ever read on the RFK assassination. I mean, that's just, it's a tremendous, and you could get interviews of her on YouTube. Mm-hmm. If you want to hear her speak about it, she's the best expert on RFK. I mean, she knows everything about him and everything about the assassination. She did a deep dive on all the declassified documents, and I mean, she's just tremendous. So that would be my recommendation.
And you trust her information?
Oh, I do, because everything. The one thing I do when I read a book like this, it's I look for the footnotes, and it's well footnoted, it's well documented.
Right.
She provides a source for everything that she says.
Oh, that's
you
good.
Know, and she did a lot of work on hypnosis and stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, like I said, there's a very small percentage that are susceptible to
sure.
it. So that's why a lot of people don't believe it, because for us it sounds like it's like voodoo, like you said,
yep.
Matt.
Well, you know, and I too look at it this way. You know, you could go out there, you could probably pick up an article today and you know start learning about this, start reading about it. You watch a video, but you know a lot of this stuff, like you said, you know, when you go to sources. you know, like an author that writes this book, she, you know, she includes a heavy detail of footnotes. Her references are listed. You know, she gives the, there's credibility to her writing, you know? Mm-hmm. But a lot of this stuff that, and, you know, I kind of want to give that a little bit of a warning message out here, too. You know, being that we did these JFK episodes, and now we did this RFK episode, you know, watch out, because there is a lot of skepticism out there that people do push and they print out, you know? Because only focus on one thing, and that one end, you know, I get it. One end, one angle, one way of persuasion, that's what they're trying to beat. Maybe that's their theory. You know, but just be careful of all the skepticism that's out there. You know, because there's,
well, if you want to further your career,
yeah,
the way to do it is to endorse the Warren Commission, or, you know what I mean? That's the way to do,
yep,
it.
And those are all good things to keep on adding into the fire. I mean, we'll use a reference there. You know, you just keep dumping gasoline on the fire. You know, those topics will just make it bigger and bigger, you know?
But there's so much disinformation. I mean, I was watching C-SPAN a couple of weeks ago, and they had a professor on, and I forget where he was from. He might have even been an Ivy League professor, and he was talking about Alan Dulles, and he was talking to a group of students, and he made Alan Dulles out to be the greatest American ever. And I'm thinking,
God,
I had to turn it off. I'm like, what is this guy? I mean, obviously this guy's intelligent.
This guy is good.
You know what I mean? He's too intelligent to actually believe what he's saying. You know what I mean? Like, how could you make this guy out to be a great American when the stuff that we know that he's done,
yep,
now, the documents that we could prove that he's done.
Oh, he's
done,
garbage on my list.
Oh, he's just a despicable individual. And for this guy, this professor, to just make him out to be this grandfatherly figure who is such the godfather of intelligence, and he's such a great American, I'm like, oh, my God. I literally had to turn it off before my TV ended up on the street.
Yeah, don't blame you.
I don't blame you on that part.
Wow.
But, I mean, that's pretty much it. I mean, that's, you know, there's some other stuff that I could have to go, that I could go into, but I figured if you want to do some of the questions.
Yeah, why don't we do some of the questions? What I'll kind of ask here is, let's do a quick little break, and then we can come back into questions. That way we're kind of organized, and we do our final wrap-up with Sean Kane here. So,
sounds
everybody
good.
Sit back, relax. We'll be right back.
All right, everybody, thanks for sticking around with us. And I think now, Sean, you wanted to discuss some questions about some previous episodes that we've received in, right?
Yes, I have a couple questions here. The first one is from our buddy Billy Raids, and he has a question that actually people ask him a lot.
Okay.
And he says that it frustrates him when he gets the question. He wanted to know if people ask me that question, if I get just as frustrated. And I do. But the question is, you know, people come up to me and they say, you know, if there, you know, was this big conspiracy, don't you think somebody would have talked? And that question just drives me crazy, because that's people that do no research, that have no idea what, they didn't read any of the million documents that were released. They know nothing of the investigations outside of the Warren Commission. And you know what? Someone would have talked. I mean, Jim Garrison talked. Look what happened to him. His entire life got destroyed. I mean, you want me to start naming the people that talked? Rose Shirami, we talked about her. She mentioned 2 days before the assassination that Kennedy was going to be assassinated. And she ended up getting run off the road. Dinkins, the Army cryptograph guy, he uncovered the assassination plot with William Harvey and Guy Bannister. And what happened to him? He got considered AWOL, and he got sent to a psychiatric hospital,
right,
for the rest of his life. Sylvia Duran talked. She ended up getting raped in a Mexican prison. Yuri Nisenko talked. He ended up in a CIA black site. Otto Opecta talked. His entire life got torn upside down. George de Morneshield talked. He ended up blowing his brains out with a shotgun. David Ferry talked. He ended up dead the next day. He named Eladio Del Valle as one of the shooters the same day that Ferry ends up dead. Del Valle gets hacked up with a machete. Johnny Roselli talked, and he ended up getting paralyzed and had his legs and arms cut off with a chainsaw while he was paralyzed. Lee Bowers talked. He said he saw something behind the grassy knoll. He ends up getting run off the road. I mean, I could just go on and on. Gary Underhill, Bruce Pitzer. I mean, Richard Case Nagel was a guy that would rather go to jail than have any involvement in this. Abraham Bolden, the Secret Service agent in Chicago, talked about the Chicago plot. he ended up getting in this trumped up investigation into to legal funds or whatever and ended up going to prison. William Sullivan was going to talk. He ended up getting shot in a hunting accident the weekend before. I mean, Roger Craig, Jack Ruby talked. Jack Ruby said another form of government is going to take over this country, right? I mean, what happened to Jack Ruby when Dr. West visited him?
Right.
I mean, Dorothy Kilgallen talked. She said she was going to blow the lid off the Kennedy assassination. She's dead the next day. I mean, Hale Boggs was on the Warren Commission. He talked to Jim Garrison. He ends up disappearing in a plane accident. I mean, how many other people were discredited? Fletcher Prouty talked. He was banned from the media. Oliver Stone talked. He got absolutely destroyed. Oliver Stone got absolutely murdered for the movie JFK. And I'm telling you, I could go through that movie, JFK, and I could tell you where everything is fact-based or where he might have took some liberties. But if you compare that movie to something like, say, The Untouchables, did you guys see The Untouchables?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a great movie. De Niro's fantastic in it. Costner's fantastic.
Yep. But
they're great.
Connery's in it, too.
Unbelievable.
Yep.
But none of that is factual. That's all made up. It's all fiction.
They're Hollywood.
It's Hollywood. It's complete. But how come nobody destroys that movie?
Right.
Like they did. They attacked the JFK movie like 2 years before it came out. They attacked it in the original script. Now, Jenna, you're a film buff.
I am.
You know that the original scripts in Hollywood very rarely are the scripts that make it to film. You know there's you know, dozens of changes before the film makes it, or the script makes it to film. Mm-hmm. They were attacking the media. The original script was leaked to the media before they even had the cast set, and they attacked the original script. They were going after that right from the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, so this question, go ahead.
I was going to say, what happens is they bring in people called script doctors, and then you can, like, change and rewrite or make any necessary changes. And, like, something that a lot of people don't know, Carrie Fisher, she was a huge script doctor in Hollywood. That's a fun fan fact.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, to compare that movie to some, like, even, like, recent films like Tom Hanks' The Post, mm-hmm. I mean, that movie is totally fiction, and yet it got praised.
Right.
It got
all
praised.
All because of Tom Hanks, that,
yeah, they called the movie The Post because it's about the Pentagon Papers. The Washington Post wasn't even the ones that leaked it. It was the New York Times. How do you call the movie The Post?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, it just drives me crazy. And then they attacked that movie, JFK. I mean,
well, if you want to add to the list, though, Sean, you want another movie that they attacked? Look at Pearl Harbor when that came out with Ben Affleck and Josh Hartnett.
I mean,
the biggest thing that they attacked it for was probably because of the romance story behind it.
But it's not a war movie. It's a love story.
Right.
But the thing is, was that attacked, though? Was that movie attacked like years before it was actually made?
No.
Like, I'm talking like.
No, this came out after the fact.
This was a concerted effort to destroy this movie before it ever even got close to film. And to tell you what's going on now is Oliver Stone is making another documentary with a researcher that I just mentioned a lot on these podcasts, James DiGenio, my favorite researcher. And they're making a documentary on the updated information on the Kennedy assassination. And the thing is, here's the thing. They're trying to get somebody to pick it up. They wanted Netflix to pick it up. Netflix said it couldn't be fact-checked because, get this, there's too many documents to go through with the new releases. There's too many pages to go through, so they can't fact-check it.
Is it technically it couldn't be fact-checked, or it just doesn't want to be touched?
They said it doesn't want to be touched. They said there's too much information to go through. I mean, everything I could tell you from everything I read with DiGenio, he footnotes everything. I mean, everything he is well documented, all his books. I mean, this is going to be, you know, I just can't wait to see it. I just don't know where we're going to see it. But to get back to that question, do you want to add anything, Jenna, to that?
Oh, no, I'm good.
You're the film buff. I mean,
I am.
It's just to me, that's just amazing that movie got attacked like it did.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, other people that talked, like Guy Bannister talked, you know, Oswald talked. He said he was a patsy.
Yep.
Sam Giancana was talking to the church committee about the Castro assassinations. He gets shot in his basement when this FBI has him 24-hour surveillance, okay? And then they take the surveillance off. Within hours, he's dead.
Yep.
I mean, Richard Miltier talked. He talked about the Florida plot. His house got blown up with him in it. I mean, the witnesses that said Oswald, Sandra Stiles and Vicki Adams that were in the depository. Julianne Mercer is another witness. They had to go into hiding. They talked. So this question that somebody would have talked. Like, do some research before you ask that stupid question.
Talk about a wide array of events, though. I mean, it just, like, the list gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Oh, yeah. I'm just naming people, you know what I mean? There's others you
can. But doesn't it go through your mind, though, like, when you, Sean, when you read that stuff, right, and you know the names and, of course, what happened, you know, this one died, this one died, oh, this one's in hiding, oh, this one, they got banned from the media. It's like, okay, they all fell like flies. That's the reference. They are all falling like flies. There's no credited source. There's nobody to go to. We have no hole open to go into, you know.
Well, another thing, it's easy for, like, us to talk about it now when most of the conspirators are dead, like, 58 years later. But for these people to come out at the time, I mean, it took a lot of guts to come out and say the things they said.
Yeah, for sure.
You know what I mean? So, yeah, I mean, but that question, like, somebody would have talked. Well, a lot of people talk. Do your research before you ask that stupid question.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. 100%. So,
anything you guys want to add to that before we go on to the next?
No, I'm good. Fire away.
Okay, so the next question, two questions that you got, Matt. Let me bring them up here. This question is from Evan. He says, Matt, I wanted to ask your special guest a question. Why does it seem he dodges the consideration towards the mob having any involvement in JFK's assassination? I often heard my grandparents say that the mafia never liked the Kennedys, obviously because he was Irish. It just seems like, even though word of mouth from grandparents and much older crowd, and even though cable shows, it seems to favor this as a possibility. What more can you support in this situation? Well, I appreciate the question, but to be honest with you, I don't think I've ever dodged that question. I think I've taken it head on, don't you guys?
I believe so.
I don't think, like, I mean, I just, there's no evidence that the mob masterminded the assassination. Now, if you want me to say that, you know, they put pressure on Ruby after the CIA went to them, that's fine. I mean, there's evidence to that. Ruby had a lot of mob ties. I mean, the thing is, but that would be the mob being subservient to the CIA, like they were.
Right.
You know, so that's not the mob running anything. That's the CIA running things and using the mob to do it. So I'd agree with that. But there's a lot to unpack. Like, the statement in there that the mob hated the Kennedys because they were Irish, I don't understand that statement. Because I know there's a rivalry between the Irish and Italians. Believe me, all my Italian friends, I got a rivalry with them. But to say that's the reason, I mean, they hated the Kennedys because they were attacking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that goes to the whole thing. Like they, why would they rig the election for them? They were going after the mafia like nobody ever did. I mean, you know, Bobby Kennedy and JFK, they were on the committee. They were going after them. And that's the reason they hated him. And as far as, like, you know, at some point we should probably do a show on the mob, because I that's something I know a lot about, and it seems like there's a lot of interest on the mob, but it seems like there's just a lot of disinformation.
Yeah, we
sure
do that.
You know, like the relationship, the Irish gangster and the Italian gangster have a relationship. So, I mean, it's like, you know, like, sure, they have had wars over the years that, you know, makes a lot of great entertainment value. But
sure.
I mean, for the most part, though, the Irish gangster and the Italian gangster work together tremendous. I mean, I could go list the names, like Jimmy Burke from Goodfellas was 100% Irish.
Hence why he couldn't be made.
Well, that's true. But, I mean, the thing is, like, it goes to show you what the mob is all about, though. The mob is solely about making money. You know, they're solely about making money. Like the whole story with the, I'm sure you're, you know, from the movie Goodfellas, the famous scene with Joe Pesci and go get your shine box and everything. That was totally made up.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Totally made up by Scorsese.
Right.
Jimmy Burke, the reason, the guy that they killed, Billy Batts, in the bar, right? He was a guy by the name of Billy Van Veda, who was a made guy in the Gambino family. Now, Van Veda went to prison, and all the five families asked Burke to take over his action because Jimmy Burke made money. There's two ways to get respect in the mob. You're either a fearless killer or you're an earner. Jimmy Burke was both.
Yeah.
Jimmy Burke made money for everybody. He was almost like an acting underboss at the Lucchese family. So what happened was Jimmy takes over Van Veda's action, And he quadruples the business. Alice, Shylock, everything. He's making money hand over fist, and he's sharing them with everybody. Jimmy Burke ran the schemes going out of JFK Airport with a young rising soldier in the Gambino family named John Gotti, and they were partners on that. And so Burke had tremendous juice inside the mob, even though he was Irish. And the thing is, when Van Veda gets out of prison, he goes to Burke and he says, "I want thanks for looking after my action, but I want my action back." And Burke told him, "Go get screwed. You're not getting nothing back." So Van Veda makes a stink about it. He goes to the bosses, and they say, "Look, find something else to do because they're making tons of money with Jimmy Burke. They don't want to upset that apple cart." Now, if it was really about a brotherhood, right, you'd think they would have sided with Van Veda, but they didn't. So Van Veda wouldn't let it go. He kept it up. So Jimmy went to Lucchese family, and he says, "I'm going to take him out." And everybody looked the other way. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy Burke and Henry Hill and the Pesci's character, which was based off a guy by the name of Tommy DeSimone, right, they killed Van Veda. But it wasn't like this spontaneous thing that they make it out over a shine box and this and that. It was a planned hit. Right. And they took him out. So that goes to show you everything that the mob is about. It's about making money. And it's not about, Irish, Italian. I mean, credit on the street. You know what I mean? Like the respect on the street. The Irish and Italian gangsters work together all the time. I mean, look up in Boston. I mean, Whitey Bulger ran that town. He was Irish, but his right hand was a guy by the name of Stephen the Rifleman Fleming, who was Italian.
Yep.
They work together all the time. So I didn't understand that part of the question. But as far as dodging it, I don't think I've ever dodged I just don't see the evidence that they planned it.
Yeah. And, I totally agree 100%. But, I mean, I think it's interesting that you brought up Whitey Bulger, though, too. Because, I mean, if you think about we want to do an episode going around the mob. No, I mean, like I said,
Well, we could. We could definitely. Because Jenna knows. I mean, I've had Jenna up in Boston, and Jenna knows. We were in Whitey Bulger's bar up there. So yeah, I know all the stories up there, and we could do a great episode on the mob.
Yeah, like, Mickey Spillane and Jack Diamond,
Everything. We could touch on Mickey Spillane, the Westies.
William McCarty.
Everybody. We could talk about everybody. And the thing is, when you're talking about organized crime, though, you're really talking about Irish, Italian, and Jewish gangsters. And that's what, I'd like to keep the show to.
Yeah.
When you're talking about American organized crime, I should say. But yeah, that would be a great episode.
I think it would be too.
Yeah, we could totally do that.
And just the other thing, the last thing to say on this, because I think we beat this to death, but if you look at, who controlled Oswald's files? It was the CIA. It wasn't the mob. I mean, who destroyed every credible investigation into the JFK assassination? It was the CIA. It wasn't the mob. It wasn't Oswald's relatives. It wasn't the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, the CIA is the one that was protecting their secret. So, I mean, like follow the money. But in this case, follow Oswald. And it leads you back to Langley. It leads you back to the CIA. It doesn't lead you back to the mafia.
Right.
So the last question, let me bring this one up. This is a real good one.
Now, is this coming from...
This is from Brett.
Okay.
He says, "Matt, I was listening to the last couple episodes of the podcast you posted on JFK. My grandfather really likes the guy you had on. Thank you for that. My question is, why is the conspiracy so dragged out? Why is that in modern times, 2021, we have not been provided the truth? I guess the better question is, how do they keep this contained year after year?" And that's just a great question. It really is. But to really, you got to understand how the power elite works. The pyramid. There's a power pyramid in this country and throughout the world, and the 1% dominate everything. And the thing is, a lot of people have a hard time understanding that because, let's face it, 99% of us are below the pyramid. So when we're looking up at the street level, we see the mob boss that's running the streets, or you see a politician, or a local businessman who's a lot of power, but you can't see the top of the pyramid. You can't see Rockefeller, Rothschild. You can't see inside the pyramid where Alan Dulles and all these guys, like Jim Garrison said, they walk between the raindrops. You know, James Angleton, you can't see these guys. Like, you can't see the power that they have. But look at why nobody wants to go up against them. Like, why do you think there was no congressional investigation into illegal funds by Rockefeller and Dulles? Nobody's taking them on. Even J. Edgar Hoover, one of the most corrupt men in history with a lot of power himself, he wasn't taking these guys on. You know what I mean? So it just – and if you want to read a couple books on this, there's a couple books. Fletcher Prouty wrote a book called The Secret Team, and there's another book called The Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And these two books, they're really good at showing you how the where the power is in this country, you know. And like you said before, like, even though it's 58 years later, you know, most of the conspirators are most likely dead. But the structure is still in place. So that secret still got to be kept because, you know, the power elite, the last names don't change. The first names might have changed as David Rockefeller passes on and everything, but the last names don't change. And the secret government that Dulles set up, that still exists today. You know what I mean? So that structure is still there. So how do they contain it? They contain it because they have tremendous power over everything, including the media.
Interesting. That was a good question. So,
it was a great question.
Who was that asked that question?
Brett, I believe.
Yeah, that was a really good question. I mean, honestly, I think I kind of just shared that feeling before in the podcast because I said, you know, when are we going to have the reveal of truth here, you know?
Well, it's just to show you the power, the control on the media is what really, and here's the thing. I want to go a little bit of deep dive for just a quick second on politics because I don't like to get too political, but the powers to be, when we talk about all these people like Dulles, Rockefeller, Curtis LeMay, Phillips, Angleton, all of them guys are right wingers. They're hardcore right wingers. I mean, that's why they supported the Nazis. They're basically fascists, and they're the ones that have the total control.
Right.
Like, there's other people that sure have power, but they have the total control, and I think they tolerate certain things from, like, say, the radical left. Like, they'll tolerate, you know, like pro-choice and stuff like that. But there's certain things they won't tolerate, and that's looking into the investigations, the assassinations of the 60s, stuff like CIA gun running and drug running, and they're just not going to touch that stuff. And I think everybody on the left understands that. And they certainly got the message in 63 and 68 that, you know, there's certain things that you could get away with, and there's certain things you can't. So I think that's part of it, too. You know what I mean? And this is why, like, Congress is not taking on David Rockefeller. Congress is not taking on Alan Dulles.
Oh, sure.
Hoover's not taking on them guys. You know, so they just have so much power. That's how they get away with it. That's why it's been dragged out for all these years. So.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you guys have anything to add on that?
No. Was that the last question that you had?
Yeah, that was it.
All right.
That was a great question. Oh, both of them were good. I appreciate the mob question, too. And like I said, I think that could lead to a great episode we should go into.
Yeah, we could totally do that.
On the mob.
Coming down the road there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so all right. Well, that about wraps us up for today. And if you guys stay tuned with us, we've got some special things cooking up in the works for you guys. So if you want to check back or check our social media and see what we've got cooking, that would be much appreciated. If you guys have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can hit us up on any of our social media pages or email us at garlicjarmedia@gmail.com. And that's about it for this one. Anybody else have any final words?
Stay cool.
Stay cool. All right, guys. So have a great week, and we'll be in touch with you on our next episode.
Bye-bye.